Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Stolen Valor Act and First Amendment Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 28, 2012, the Supreme Court announced its decision in United States v. Alvarez. The question in this case was whether the Stolen Valor Act, which makes it a crime to represent falsely that one has received military medals or decorations, violates the First Amendment. The court held by a vote of 6-3 that the act violates the First Amendment. In an opinion joined by the Chief Justice, as well as Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor, Justice Kennedy concluded that the act infringed upon speech protected by the First Amendment and could not pass strict scrutiny. Concurring in the judgment, Justice Breyer, joined by Justice Kagan, concluded that the act worked disproportionate constitutional harm and failed intermediate scrutiny. Justice Alito filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Justices Scalia and Thomas. To discuss the case, we have Eugene Volokh, who is the Gary T. Schwartz Professor of Law at UCLA School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Volokh.
When may the government punish knowing lies, outright lies? That's an important question that has long been unresolved, and unfortunately it remains unresolved after last month's decision in United States v. Alvarez. This question comes up in a vast range of situations. Defamation, perjury, attempts to get money and other commercially valuable things by fraud, the so-called false light tort, which covers even non-defamatory but offensive knowingly false statements about another person, or intentional infliction of emotional distress through knowing falsehood. For instance, when a person tells a listener and knows that this is false, that the listener's spouse has been badly injured in an accident. That's a classic example of intentional infliction of emotional distress from the restatement of torts. Or trade libel, which is to say knowingly false statements disparaging a product, and the related tort of slander of title, which are knowingly false statements casting doubt on someone's ownership of property. There are other examples. In addition to perjury, the law punishes unsworn knowingly false statements to government officials, whether under general laws such as the federal 18 U.S.C. Code Section 1001, or state and federal laws prohibiting obstruction of justice through falsehood or the making of knowingly false police reports. Likewise, the law may punish knowingly false statements likely to provoke public panic, such as Justice Holmes' famous example of falsely shouting fire in a crowded theater, or federal regulations banning broadcast hoaxes or false reports of terrorist attacks. The law also punishes impersonating government officials, even when this doesn't involve fraudulently depriving anyone of money or property. In many states, the law bans knowingly false statements that represent the speaker as having a particular university degree or professional license, regardless of whether the false representation is intended to defraud a prospective employer or a professional client. The law punishes knowingly providing a false Social Security number, even where there is no purpose to defraud anyone of anything of pecuniary value, and when the statement isn't made to government agents. Likewise, some cases have held that knowing falsehoods to voters about the authorship of endorsement of political campaign materials are punishable by federal or state law, as in many states are knowingly false statements in an election campaign about whether one is an incumbent or not. Finally, and most controversially, in some states, some laws ban all knowingly false statements in an election campaign, and lower courts have split as to whether those particular election laws are constitutional. So what do you do about this vast range of knowing falsehoods that the law in many instances prohibits, and often uncontroversially prohibits? There are at least three possible approaches to these kinds of statements. Approach number one is to say, in the words of a 1974 Supreme Court libel decision, that there is no constitutional value in false statements of fact, and that knowing falsehoods are therefore generally unprotected in all of the categories that I described above. To be sure, fiction, parody, hyperbole, and other statements that aren't reasonably seen as conveying a statement of fact are constitutionally protected. We're talking here only about knowingly false statements of fact that are likely to be perceived as falsehoods as opposed to obvious fiction. Also, the Supreme Court has held that innocent mistakes are often, in fact, usually constitutionally protected, since otherwise people might be deterred from saying even true things for fear that they might be mistaken. The court's libel cases have chiefly focused on figuring out the rules related to this and have generally accepted that outright knowing falsehoods are punishable. Finally, statements about some subjects, such as about history, about science, or about conduct by the government generally, rather than about the conduct of specific named officials, might also be protected even when a jury finds that they're knowingly false. It may be too dangerous to political or scholarly debate to give government officials the power to brand some factual claims as lies and to punish people for spreading such claims. But outside these categories, under this first approach that I'm outlining, knowing falsehoods would be punishable. A second possible approach is the opposite, to say that even knowing falsehoods are constitutionally protected, unless they fall into certain narrow categories of knowing falsehoods, such as defamation, perjury, and fraud. So as a result, there wouldn't be one First Amendment exception for knowing falsehoods. There would be several narrower exceptions for particular kinds of knowing falsehoods. Finally, a third possible approach is to say that knowing falsehoods form a less protected category of speech, but not necessarily a categorically unprotected category. The analogy might be truthful commercial advertising, which is not fully protected, but is not fully unprotected either under the court's First Amendment doctrine. Under this approach, restrictions on knowing falsehoods will then be judged under some less demanding standards than the so-called strict scrutiny that's applied to laws that restrict true statements and opinions. So once a statement is found to be a knowing falsehood, then a lower standard of constitutional protection would be applied to it. And when a law specifically targets only knowing falsehoods, it would be judged under this less demanding standard. In United States v. Alvarez, the justices split into three camps that correspond to these approaches. And none of these camps, unfortunately, got a majority. The facts of the case, Javier Alvarez was an elected member of a water district board in California. And at one of the meetings of the board, he claimed to have gotten the Congressional Medal of Honor. This was a lie. And it happened to violate the Stolen Valor Act, a recently enacted federal statute that makes it a crime to make a knowingly false claim that one has received a military medal. The Stolen Valor Act applies to all such knowing lies about having gotten a medal, regardless of whether they're in a political election campaign, regardless of whether they're aimed at getting money or a job or a contract or a government benefit or what have you. The question in the case was whether this law, the Stolen Valor Act, was constitutional. A four-justice plurality, Justice Kennedy, joined by Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor, so basically two conservative members of the court and two liberal ones, took the view that even knowing falsehoods are generally constitutionally protected, unless they fit within several narrow exceptions. The Stolen Valor Act didn't fit within those exceptions and was therefore, according to the plurality, unconstitutional. Unfortunately, the plurality didn't say much about what those exceptions were. It did say that defamation, perjury, and financial fraud are constitutionally unprotected, so it seemed to recognize exceptions for those kinds of knowing falsehoods. Plurality suggested that even unsworn lies to government officials would qualify, as would impersonation of government officials, although it's not clear exactly what the scope of those exceptions would be. And beyond that, the plurality was unclear. Would some of the laws I mentioned at the outset be unconstitutional under the plurality's test? What about bans on certain attempts to defraud voters? For instance, bans targeted to candidates falsifying their own resumes in an election campaign or claiming to be incumbents when they're not. We don't know what the plurality will do with that because the plurality, while it said there is no categorical exception for knowingly false statements of fact and said there are some narrower exceptions for certain kinds of such statements, didn't tell us much about what those exceptions are or how one is to derive them. A two-justice concurrence, Justice Breyer, joined by Justice Kagan, took the view that knowing falsehoods are a less protected category of speech and that restrictions on such falsehoods are constitutional if they pass so-called intermediate scrutiny. Yet these justices also concluded that the Stolen Valor Act is unconstitutional because, they said, it's broader than necessary. First, the justices concluded the government's interest in maintaining the value of military decorations by preventing their dilution through false claims could be just as well served by maintaining an official internet-accessible list of medal recipients. That's a classic, less restrictive alternative argument, that you don't have to restrict this kind of speech, which concurring justices said has some constitutional value. You don't have to restrict the speech to achieve your government interest because you can achieve it just as well through other means, for example, having this master database that listeners could look up. Second, they concluded that because the law extended even to private conversations, it was too broad, that their view seems to be that lies in ordinary social contexts should be categorically protected, I suppose, unless they are something like libel or other kinds of harmful falsehoods that historically have been punishable even in private conversations. Third, the concurring justices suggested that a law that applied to only a narrower range of medals and a narrower range of statements might be constitutional. But they didn't say specifically how narrow the law had to be. Interestingly, the concurring justices seem to take the view that there's a First Amendment line between lies aimed at getting money, even modest amount of money, and lies aimed at getting unearned respect or affection. And the plurality justices seem to take this view as well. After all, it's well established that lying to get money, say a charitable contribution, is punishable, even if you're only lying to get a contribution of $20 or $50. The court has held that before. But according to the plurality and the concurrence, lying to get respect, which is after all what most people are trying to do when they claim to have military medals, is not punishable. Now, such a distinction between financial frauds and social frauds, defrauding people of money and defrauding people of their honest affection, defrauding people in a way that causes them to have respect and affection for you as a result of a lie, that line is present in ordinary criminal law and tort law of fraud. But Alvarez was the first time the court has said that this distinction is constitutionally mandated, that as a First Amendment matter, a lie that defraud people in a way that causes them to give you unearned respect are constitutionally not punishable, whereas if the lies are aimed at defrauding people out of money, that is constitutionally punishable. Finally, three dissenters, Justice Alito, joined by Justices Scalia and Thomas, took the view that knowing falsehoods are categorically unprotected, with the exception mentioned before for scientific, historical, or political claims. They therefore said the Stolen Valor Act should have been upheld, and the rationale would have upheld all the other laws I mentioned at the outset, with a possible exception of the controversial bans on all lies in election campaigns. Their view was that, in fact, the alternatives suggested by the challengers of the law, that the government could just put up a database with information on who actually is entitled to medals, wouldn't do it nearly as good a job as an actual prohibition on false claims of medals. But beyond that, they said that that shouldn't really matter as a constitutional matter, because once one concludes that knowing lies are categorically constitutionally unprotected, then the government may ban them even without an eye towards whether there are less restrictive alternatives. So where does this leave us? The answer is nobody knows for sure. There was no majority opinion, and the concurrence and the plurality take very different approaches to the general question, so it's hard to even to synthesize a common link between them. It's clear that obvious fiction, hyperbole, and parody remains constitutionally protected. There was no dispute about that. The justices did reaffirm that bans on lies about history, such as Holocaust denial laws, or bans on so-called group libel, which is to say bans on false statements about particular racial, ethnic, or religious groups, are unconstitutional. But that, too, has been pretty clear for the last several decades. The justices did strike down the Stolen Valor Act, that much is clear, but the concurring justices suggested they might uphold a narrower law without saying how narrow it had to be. Presumably Congress will go back to the drawing board and try to create a narrower law that might satisfy five justices, but it's not clear exactly how narrow that law must be in order to be narrow enough for the concurrence. Finally, what about the category of bans that I think is the most practically important, at least of the controversial ones, and that's bans on lies in election campaigns, especially when the lies are said by a candidate? As I mentioned, some states have had such bans, and lower courts are split on whether those bans are constitutional. On the one hand, such lies are actually a form of financial fraud. The candidate is seeking something of monetary value, a job that pays a salary, by lying to the people who would have to pay the salary, the taxpaying voters. That's a kind of resume fraud that, outside the election context, would probably be treated as much the same as defrauding somebody outright out of money, because after all, it is defrauding somebody outright out of money. Moreover, the government interest in preventing fraud on voters seems particularly strong. On the other hand, at least some lies for which candidates are faulted will often involve controversial political claims, not just resume fraud or lies about endorsements, but questions about, for instance, just how to measure governmental deficit or whether some law is working in a particular way or not. Moreover, as the concurrence pointed out, decisions by prosecutors or election commissions to prosecute a candidate for such alleged lies may well be politically selective, and that might pose special First Amendment problems. My guess is the courts will uphold laws that ban narrow and easily verifiable lies in elections, such as a candidate's lies about his resume, lies about who endorsed him, or dirty tricks about where voting locations are or what day the election is, say, pre-recorded messages that encourage people to show up the wrong day for the election or in the wrong place. At the same time, more general bans on lies in elections will probably be struck down because they're too likely to involve contested questions where people's judgment about what is actually true, that's say prosecutors and election commission officials and jurors' judgment, will be influenced by their politics. But these are unfortunately just guesses. The split decision in Alvarez, coupled with the plurality's vagueness and the exceptions that it would recognize, and the concurrence's vague intermediate scrutiny test, makes it hard to say much about this basic question of First Amendment law. When are knowing lies treated as constitutionally protected speech?
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.